This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Nancy McFarland saw a lot of changes in her 12 years on the Raleigh City Council. The last 8 of those, she served as mayor. And during that time, Raleigh became one of the fastest growing cities in the state. With that influx of people came a new set of challenges: affordable housing, improved public transportation, and widening roads. The city council worked to address the issues, but some critics say they didn't do enough. Nancy McFarland handed over the gavel earlier this week to her successor, former city council member Mary Ann Baldwin. And Nancy McFarland joins us now to look back at her career and talk about what she's doing next. Nancy, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
You got here in, joined the council in 2007. How did you get interested in public service?
Well, it really was my children were going to school, and I was working as a pharmacist at Raleigh Community Hospital with Roxy Cash, and she decided to run for school board. In talking with her, I really understood how much local government decisions affected my children's education. So I started working on her campaign and working on other people's campaigns and bond campaigns, and really didn't have any interest in running myself. I started a business in 2002. And then in, I had 3 children, too, at home. And 2007, the business was big enough that I had great managers, and my youngest was a senior in high school, and I had been friends with the then mayor, Charles Meeker, for quite a while. He kept encouraging me to run, so finally I thought, okay, I'll try it. And I ran for District A, and then I got on the council, and then Charles was, you need to run for mayor, you need to run for mayor. And I was like, no, I don't want it. But he ended up doing it for 4 years after I was on council. He did it for 10 altogether. And, you know, you get invested. You're working on projects. You're making things happen. And he's stepping away. And, I felt like if I don't step up, then a lot of the good work we're doing may go away.
What did you learn about the process, how a bill actually becomes law, how ideas actually get translated into action, both from the campaigning, those very early steps where you're working on bond campaigns, helping other people get elected, and then you're on the council? Obviously, you go in with a sense of mission, and then you see how the process works. What did you learn in that process?
Well, I learned that government moves really slow, especially coming from a business background, because it's, you know, and there's a reason. Because there is a lot of process, and you can have a great idea, but it's, you know, you get, there's a lot of community input along the way, and things go to the Planning Commission, and they vet it from their perspective, and then they come back to us. And I think that I was just really surprised how long some things took. I'm still surprised at how long some things take to happen.
What about you're not mayor anymore, so tell me the answer to this. What about the input, community input? Obviously it matters, but there are people, individuals and businesses with outsized influence. What's the ratio, and how,
well,
how what are we up against?
It is interesting because, you know, we have a often have a system where you are exactly right. The loudest voices in the room seem to have the most influence, but I think that is really incumbent on the elected officials, the members of the city council, to understand that they are making decisions for a city of 500,000. And you may have 3 or 4 very loud voices, but we know more than they do. You know, we are stewards of the city, and we have a responsibility to make good decisions that benefit everyone. And, you know, lots of times somebody's not happy, but and that is, you know, sometimes was frustrating because sometimes if that's all you hear, you know, right, some people may tend to go with that, but it really does take the ability to sit back and consider everything.
When you talked about that transition, 2 terms as city council member before becoming mayor, what was that transition like for you?
Well, it was, I was shocked. I mean, I really thought it was, I would just be a busier city councilor, but it is much more responsibility. You're involved in a lot more things, but I did a lot of, things. I engaged in the Metropolitan Mayors, which is, or Metro Mayors of North Carolina, which is the largest cities that come together, and we address things like transportation, work with the legislature, I also engaged in the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and that was great because mayors are very much, you know, it's all about sharing ideas. You don't have to reinvent the wheel, and mayors are not, you know, this is my stuff, you can't have it. You know, they're very, here, take it and see if it works in their, in your community. It's interesting because, you know, within when you're with 250 mayors, there really is no party craziness because you have got to, you know, we were kind of laughed the last time we were together last January was in, we were in Washington, D.C., and it was the government shutdown. And we were kind of laughing as in, can you imagine if we did this? Yeah. You know, I'm sorry you called 911, but no one's going to answer the phone or we can't get your water on. Or, I mean, that's not an option for us, you know. So it's a, it's a great learning experience, but it's all that kind of stuff also takes.
You talked
time.
About working with the legislature, and I know I've seen and heard you say that one of your proudest accomplishments was acquiring the property for the Dorothea Dix Park from the state. Talk about that process.
Well, I did it twice. We got it, and I'm sorry for my voice.
It's very kind of you, by the way. We should point out to come on with a cold yes. that you are struggling with, but I appreciate your being willing to talk
well,
to us.
Thank you. I was hoping this would be my, you know, Kathleen Turner gravelly voice, but I think it's more B. Arthur. But so I worked with a group that called themselves the Dix Visionaries that were working very hard with then-Governor Perdue to try to get her to either donate or transfer the property to the city or do something. And we worked and worked and worked, and we came up with a long-term lease and signed the lease. And it was like December, the end of her term. And then we got a new governor and a new legislature, and they wanted to negate the lease. They didn't think it was, I mean, it had the big seal of North Carolina on it. It looked valid to me. So I talked with Governor McCrory, and we agreed to a standstill agreement. So the legislature would just hold their horses while we tried to work out whatever this new deal was going to be. And we ended up purchasing it, which I think really is better in the long run. I mean,
and we should take one step back and talk about this property for people who don't know.
Right.
Certainly when it was in the news, we were all very familiar with it. The property goes back a long, long way and most recently had been owned by and operated by the state as a metal facility.
Right.
And then it was closed. And so now this large piece of property.
308 acres. And it's just, the topography is beautiful. The trees, there was a, it's been, you know, a plantation. We had a Civil War encampment there after, during the war. I mean, we've had so many. We've had Native Americans that lived there. So it's a very rich history, but it's also, we're very blessed with, like I said, this beautiful rolling topography and these 200-year-old trees. And so we had a, the really sort of the fight was the state realized it was valuable property. And there were people in the state that wanted to carve it up and develop it. And the rest of us thought, no, we really need to save this as open space in downtown Raleigh for a destination park. And so that was the fundamental battle.
So how did that actually play out? Because, again, when there's that much money to be made, ordinarily, in a place like downtown Raleigh, this is, we're talking 2010, 2011, it's one of the fastest growing cities in the country in a lot of ways. The amount of money that could have been made was enormous. What were the pressures and what were the fights and what were the countervailing forces? Because I don't, let me just for a moment, just realistically, not cynically, put aside the idea that only good government came to the rescue here. There had to be some real hard negotiations about values and replacing values and helping people who could have made a lot of money feel better about walking away.
Well, I think we did a lot of research on parks, especially large parks like that, and their effect on cities. And if you want to look at it from purely an economical point, I mean, it is a huge economic driver. And you look at the property that surrounds it, and we went and looked at Bryant Park in New York, which used to be called Needle Park. And then when they redid it, of course, New York has way more money than we did, but when they redid it, just the revitalization of the whole area around it. And we really saw this as a part of the capital city, a resource for the whole state. I mean, I think when people come to experience Raleigh as the capital, that this, without a doubt, will be a part of that experience. And so a lot of it was making that financial argument. And we had people that did white papers, and we put that in front of, you know, I think you're exactly right. There's the people that, you know, personally wanted it developed because that was their business, or they stood to benefit, or they were looking at making deals. We still had outcry from the mental health community that didn't understand that we, the city, were not closing the hospital. It had already been closed. Yeah, that decision had been made, and they were no longer there. So there were, you know, it's very hard to take an abstract idea like a destination park. We had some students, some graphic design students, just come up with ideas of what they thought it could be, and some of them were just fascinating. With 308 acres, you have a lot of different opportunities. So I think it was, you know, there is some of that.
Well, talk about, forgive me for interrupting, but talk about what we have there now, because the ideas that won and the way it has been developed now.
So we have about 1.5 million square feet of buildings, and we have an old steam-powered plant that powers them. DHHS and some other state agencies are occupying a lot of them. But a lot of them are empty. The old, there's three beautiful stone houses when you first drive in. There's a whole lot of smaller brick houses that a lot of the physicians lived in and staff lived in back when it was a working hospital. We also have, you know how there's antiques and there's old furniture?
Yeah.
Well, we got some old furniture, you know. We got, but okay. What we're doing is really going through that process of looking at all of these buildings. We have a master plan, so we have an idea of what some of them could be used for. Mm-hmm. Some of them just need to come down. But every single one of them is a cost of tearing it down or rehabbing it, because they're all full of asbestos and lead paint and who knows what else. You know, one of the things we want to do, there's a creek, no one would know it, that runs along Western Boulevard. We want to pull that out, make that like 100 feet wide for kids to play in, and actually have a water feature in Raleigh, which we don't have, but we have to move part of the landfill to do that. Wow. So,
well, and I think we have examples too of cities that were once cool that just aren't any. Have cities like Austin where they didn't, you know, weren't quite so mindful about how they were going to grow, and in some ways are paying a price.
Mm-hmm. I know that they really struggled years ago with traffic. And made the decision, if we just don't expand our infrastructure, people will stop moving here. And that didn't really work. Yeah. So now their traffic is really, really problematic. But, you know, before I even became mayor, there was this group with Greg Poole and Jim Goodman and I think Ann Goodnight and blanket everybody's
some of the movers and the shakers, yeah.
That were really, really saw the value. And ironically, you know, a lot of those them were developers. But they understood the need and the value of having this park. And it's been fascinating working with NC State, especially a lot of their researchers. And now we're all hearing about, you know, what being in nature does for mental health, and which is ironic because that's what Dorothea Dix believes. So,
what were some of your biggest frustrations?
I think some of my biggest frustrations with the park are in general.
No, in general as mayor. Yeah.
I think it's the slowness with which things take. And then sometimes, like I said, I would go to these conferences and come back with all these great ideas, but they're also might be from a city that has a strong mayor form of government, and they can decide, all right, we're going to have this department of whatever. This is a mayor manager or council manager form of government. So It's very different.
Public transportation, mass transportation.
Oh. So when I was cleaning out my office, I found the map for the light rail through Wake County. You know, I grew up in Northern Virginia, and I was in high school when they put the metro in. And everybody just thought it was the worst thing. We don't need it. Hmm. I mean, it's a disaster up there, and they have the metro.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is one thing that makes me a little crazy that we have to have a triangle-wide transportation system that works, because this area is going to keep growing. And you see it here, but you go Raleigh to Cary to Apex. You don't tell where one ends, and pretty soon it's going to be one big. That's why it's so important for us to plan together, which we are. But then we had the Durham Orange Light Rail fell apart, and we're doing bus rapid transit, and we're still arguing over, you know, got the commuter rail going on. So I am glad that we've all passed the referendums, but we have got to get a cohesive plan. And I think most importantly, one that people want to use, not just have to use, but want to use.
Affordable housing, another big tough nut to crack for big city mayors. Right. And you've come under some criticism for being somebody who seemed to go into office saying we're going to put a check on growth here and make sure we've got affordable housing, and were criticized toward the end of sort of caving into developers. And,
well, you know, that there was a campaign, so some of that was, you know, we spent $22 million last year for affordable housing. And I have a graph chart in my office that shows the number of units. I mean, we did 1,000 units last year. We are doing more. And in fact, we had someone from the state come before us that said, Raleigh is the one doing it right, and the rest of the state should be watching Raleigh. So you know, if you say it enough in a campaign,
perception,
then it's true. But it's I'm not saying we solved it because we can't solve it. And every growing city is facing this. One of the things we're doing that I think is really helpful is we are watching those sort of naturally occurring affordable housing units, apartments that they might be letting slip. And then oftentimes we will work with partners, go in, purchase them, and then bring them up to a standard without really raising the rents. Or we may raise them $50 or something and then have a fund that can help people. So that's, we're not landlords. We do best when we work with DHIC or other partners. And we've done a lot of senior affordable housing. We've done the last project we did at Washington Terrace has a daycare in it that is huge.
Tell me a little bit more about Washington Terrace, because
it's amazing. It was built in the 50s, and it actually was on the open market. And
It had been
affordable housing in the 50s, and primarily it was African American, and it was really, really, really run down. I can't remember how many years ago this was, four maybe, and it was on the market to be sold as, you know, a teardown, and this luxury condo is near downtown. And Greg Warren came to us in December, and he said, basically, I need $2 million. I don't have a plan, but I want to...
And tell us who Greg is.
Greg Warren is the head of DHIC. Oh. And so we gave him the money and worked with him over the years, and they relocated people. Nobody was ever, like, just ousted. They all had a place to live, and a lot of people came back. I met people that lived there 60 years. It was amazing. And they also have a fund to guarantee that nobody's rent went up more than a certain amount, but they've got a great playground. They've got learning gardens, but the daycare is such an important part of, you know, dependable, affordable, good quality daycare is a huge piece that we're missing in this country.
Right.
And it's to have that built into this affordable unit. I mean, I met a...
And, well, forgive me, and not lost to luxury condos. So
right.
A,
so
not lost,
we,
and B,
so that was
improved.
A huge project for us.
What are you going to do now?
Well, I'm on the board of the Dix Park Conservancy. I'm working with NCDOT on a... commission called NC First, and we are looking at how are we going to pay for infrastructure in the state, because the gas tax is probably not the long-term answer. And, you know, I have two grandchildren. That's fun. I'm on the board of the Pharmacy Foundation for the UNC School of Pharmacy, so I've still got a few things to do.
Not a lot of spare time yet. Nancy,
you know, how it is.
Former mayor of Raleigh. Nancy, thank you so much for talking with
us. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of the Burlington Boys Choir, live on the State of Things. Stay with us.